A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's genuinely one of those questions where the surface answer is simple, but the machinery underneath is fascinating. He's asking, when a country announces an arms embargo on Israel, or on anyone, what actually happens? How do you enforce it? Because presumably, weapons exports are already tightly controlled. And then there's the related question about military aid, with strings attached. The oversight regimes that are supposed to make sure American or German weapons aren't being used in ways that violate international law. How does that actually work in practice? Not the press release version, the real version.
This is exactly the right moment to be asking it. During the Gaza war, we saw this cascade of embargo announcements. Canada, Belgium, Spain, Italy, Japan, all announcing partial or full arms embargoes on Israel. But then you'd see reports suggesting components were still flowing. Contracts were still being honored. Things were getting through. So the question becomes, is an embargo a real shutdown, or is it a diplomatic press release with a complicated enforcement asterisk?
The diplomatic press release with an asterisk is basically the national bird of international relations.
Here's the thing that most coverage misses. Arms exports are already one of the most tightly regulated categories of international trade. You've got export licenses, end-user certificates, dual-use regulations, the Wassenaar arrangement. An embargo isn't creating controls from scratch. It's adding another layer on top of an already complex system. So the real question is, does that extra layer actually do anything?
It's not like before the embargo, you could just FedEx a crate of artillery shells to a foreign military with a nice note. There were already rules. So what does the embargo change?
Let's start with what an arms embargo actually is. At its core, it's a policy decision that changes the criteria by which export licenses are evaluated. Under normal circumstances, a country's export control agency reviews applications against a set of criteria. Things like, does this violate our international commitments? Will this contribute to regional instability? Is there a risk of diversion to unauthorized users? An embargo, essentially hard, codes the answer to some of those questions. It says, for this destination, the answer is no, regardless of other factors.
It's a policy override on the normal review process.
But here's the first catch, and this is where the grandfathering problem comes in. Most embargoes only apply to new license applications. They don't automatically revoke existing licenses that were already approved. So, if a company has a valid export license that was granted before the embargo was announced, in many cases, they can still fulfill that order.
Which means you can announce an embargo, and shipments keep going out the door for months or even years.
This isn't a loophole, it's the standard design. Look at Italy. In December 2023, Italy announced an embargo on new arms contracts with Israel, but that didn't affect previously approved deals, and those deals were substantial. We're talking about an estimated 100 million euros in existing contracts that were explicitly carved out. The Italian government wasn't hiding this. They said, we're banning new contracts, but honoring existing ones. That's a policy choice.
The embargo headline and the embargo reality are two very different things. The headline says, Italy bans arms sales to Israel. The reality says, Italy bans new arms sales to Israel, while continuing to ship everything it already agreed to ship.
Italy is not unique here. Canada announced an arms embargo on Israel in January 2024, initially presented as a comprehensive ban. But it later emerged that 30 previously approved export permits, worth about $28 million Canadian, were still valid. Only new applications were blocked. The existing permits kept moving.
28 million isn't nothing.
It's not nothing, and the optics are terrible, because you've got a government standing at a podium saying we've banned arms exports, while the customs paperwork tells a different story. But this gets to the core of how these systems actually work. The licensing pipeline has inertia. A company applies, the government reviews, the license is granted, and then there's a whole fulfillment timeline. Manufacturing, shipping, delivery. An embargo announcement doesn't reach into that pipeline and freeze everything in place. It only affects what enters the pipeline after the announcement date.
The pipeline metaphor is useful. It's like turning off a tap, but there's still water in the hose.
Depending on how long that hose is, the water can keep flowing for quite a while. Now, that's the licensing side. But there's a second major mechanism here, and it's where things get even more interesting. We have to distinguish between two fundamentally different types of arms transfers. One is government to government. That's where the supplying country's government is directly involved, often through programs like the U.S. Foreign Military Sales System. The other is commercial sales, where a private company sells to a foreign buyer, and the government's role is purely regulatory. It grants or denies the license, but it's not a party to the transaction.
I'm guessing enforcement looks very different across those two channels.
On the government-to-government side, the supplying country typically retains some form of oversight. Under the U.S. Foreign Military Sales Program, for example, the United States doesn't just hand over equipment and walk away. There are end-use monitoring requirements. U.S. personnel can physically inspect the equipment. They conduct regular checks to verify that what was shipped is still where it's supposed to be and is being used for the purposes stated in the agreement.
They can literally send someone to look at the missiles.
In theory, yes. The Defense Security Cooperation Agency, which runs the FMS program, has a whole compliance and monitoring infrastructure. They do pre-shipment checks, post-shipment verification, and periodic re-inspections. For sensitive items, they can require the recipient to provide regular reports on inventory status and usage. And if the recipient refuses access or can't account for equipment, the U.S. can suspend further transfers. And that's the phrase that's going to come up a lot in this conversation. Because the gap between the theory and the practice is where the whole enforcement question lives. Let me give you a number that makes this concrete. In March 2025, the U.S. Government Accountability Office issued a report on end-use monitoring of military aid to Israel. The GAO found that the State Department did not conduct a single end-use monitoring visit to Israel during 2024.
Zero visits, while $3.8 billion in foreign military financing was flowing.
$3.8 billion. And this isn't a minor administrative oversight. The GAO is the watchdog. When they flag something like this, it means the oversight regime that everyone assumes is functioning simply wasn't being applied. The mechanisms exist on paper, the personnel exist, the procedures exist, but the political decision to actually deploy them wasn't made.
The oversight is real, the infrastructure is real, but it's discretionary. You can just not use it.
That's the key insight. Enforcement is fundamentally a political will problem, not a technical one. The systems for monitoring end use are well established. The U.S. has been doing this for decades. But whether those systems are actively employed depends on the diplomatic relationship, the strategic priorities, and frankly, how much the supplying country actually wants to know what's happening with its weapons.
Don't ask, don't tell. But for artillery shells...
That's not an unfair characterization. And it gets even more complicated on the commercial side, which is where the vast majority of the arms trade actually happens. When a private company exports weapons or components, the enforcement mechanism is fundamentally different. There's no embedded U.S. military officer doing inspections. There's no government-to-government agreement with monitoring provisions. There's a piece of paper called an end-user certificate.
A piece of paper.
The exporter submits it as part of the license application, certifying who the end user is and what the items will be used for. The importing entity signs it, often with some kind of government stamp. And then, in most cases, that's it. The shipment goes out, the certificate goes in a file, and nobody ever physically verifies that the items ended up where the certificate said they would.
The entire enforcement architecture for commercial arms sales is a pinky promise with a notary stamp.
I want to push back slightly because that's a bit too cynical. Some countries do conduct post-shipment verification. The UK, for example, has the Export Control Joint Unit, the ECJU. They process about 12,000 license applications per year. And they do conduct post-shipment checks. But here's the number. They only do a few hundred of those checks annually, out of 12,000 licenses. And those checks often take the form of a letter to the foreign government or the end user asking for confirmation, rather than a physical inspection.
They send a letter asking... Did you use those missiles responsibly?
It's a bit more formal than that, but structurally, yes. The verification mechanism for commercial exports is overwhelmingly paper-based, and this is not a secret. It's well understood within the export control community. The resources simply don't exist to do comprehensive physical verification of every export, so you're relying on the integrity of the documentation and the good faith of the recipient.
Which brings us to the dual-use problem.
Which is enormous, and this is where the embargo framework really starts to strain. A lot of what goes into modern weapon systems is not uniquely military. Drone motors are just brushless electric motors. GPS modules are the same ones you'd find in a smartphone. Night vision optics use components that are also in high-end camera equipment. Semiconductor chips, carbon fiber, specialized alloys, all of these have legitimate civilian applications. And most arms embargoes explicitly exclude dual-use items, or only cover them if the exporter knows they're intended for military use.
If I'm exporting drone motors, and I declare them as hobbyist components for a civilian distributor, and the embargo only covers military end use, I might be completely legal.
You might be. And customs officials at the port of export have to make a judgment call about whether a shipment of brushless motors is going to a hobby shop or a weapons assembly facility. They're not intelligence analysts. They're looking at shipping manifests and customs declarations. If the paperwork says commercial electronics and the dual-use regulations don't explicitly prohibit that destination for those items, the shipment goes through.
The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. It looks innocuous because it is innocuous until you know where it's going.
This played out in a very concrete way during the Gaza War. In April 2026, just a couple of months ago, Belgian customs authorities at the port of Antwerp seized a shipment of military equipment that was being sent from Britain to Israel. The shipment was flagged because it passed through Belgian territory and Belgium had imposed an arms embargo. The Belgian authorities intercepted it. But here's the telling detail. The shipment was commercial. It was transiting through a third country, and it took Belgian customs to catch it, not British export controls.
The UK system didn't stop it from leaving. It took a different country's port authorities to intercept it mid-journey.
And this illustrates the transshipment problem. Even if country A has an embargo, the goods can be routed through country B, which may have different rules, different enforcement capacity, or different political priorities. And once the shipment is in international transit, the chain of custody becomes much harder to track.
This is like trying to enforce a no-alcohol policy at a party by checking invitations at the front door, while people are passing bottles through the back window.
The back window is often a friendly neighbor. There have been persistent reports of German-made components reaching Israel through third countries despite Germany's stated policy of restraint after October 7, 2023. Germany's export control system is considered one of the more stringent in Europe, but Germany doesn't control the customs authorities of every country those components might pass through.
Let's talk about Germany specifically, because you mentioned their policy of restraint. What did that actually look like in practice?
This is where the numbers tell a story that the rhetoric doesn't. In 2022, Germany approved about 32 million euros in arms exports to Israel. In 2024, after October 7th, after the government's stated policy of restraint, German arms export approvals to Israel increased tenfold to over 320 million euros.
A tenfold increase during a period of restraint.
The German government would argue that many of these approvals were for contracts that were already in the pipeline, or for components of cooperative programs that couldn't be unilaterally halted without breaching international agreements. But the optics are what they are. You announce restraint, and the numbers go up by a factor of 10.
It's the diplomatic equivalent of saying, I'm on a diet, while ordering dessert. The words and the calories are going in different directions.
This gets to something important about how these systems interact with international cooperation. A lot of modern weapons are produced through multinational consortia. The F-35, for example, has components from multiple countries. If one country in the supply chain announces an embargo, does it have the legal authority to stop components that are part of a multinational program? The answer is often legally ambiguous and politically fraught.
The embargo isn't just a domestic policy decision. It's a grenade rolled into a web of international contracts and obligations.
Nobody wants to be the country that breaks the F-35 supply chain over a policy dispute. That's the kind of thing that gets you uninvited from future consortium meetings. So what often happens is that the embargo is carefully worded to exclude cooperative programs or to allow exceptions for existing contractual obligations. Which brings us back to the grandfathering problem, but at a multinational scale.
Let me try to synthesize what we've covered so far. An arms embargo can be undermined by existing contracts, dual-use classification, third-country transshipment, multinational program obligations, and the simple fact that enforcement agencies are under-resourced and politically constrained. And that's before we even get to the question of deliberate evasion.
That's a good summary. And deliberate evasion is its own category. But I want to focus on something that's less about evasion and more about the structural limitations of enforcement, because I think this is what the prompt is really getting at. Even when everyone is acting in good faith, the system has inherent weaknesses. Customs officials have to identify prohibited items among millions of shipments. They need specific intelligence about which shipments to flag. They need training to recognize dual-use components that might be declared as something else. And they need political backing to actually seize shipments from politically sensitive destinations.
If any of those things is missing, the enforcement crumbles.
It doesn't crumble entirely. It becomes selective. Some things get caught, many things don't. And the selection is often driven by factors that have nothing to do with the embargo policy itself. It's about which ports have better scanning equipment, which customs agencies have better intelligence sharing relationships, which shipments happen to be selected for random inspection.
The enforcement is only as good as its weakest customs inspector.
Customs inspectors are already overwhelmed. The volume of global trade is staggering. A major port like Antwerp or Rotterdam processes millions of containers per year. Physical inspection rates are typically in the low single digits. The system relies overwhelmingly on documentation review and risk profiling. If the documentation is clean and the risk profile doesn't flag the shipment, it moves through.
We've covered the practical enforcement challenges, but there's a second dimension to the prompt that I want to make sure we address. The question about conditioned military aid and oversight regimes. When the US or Germany provides military aid, there's supposed to be some mechanism to ensure the weapons are used in accordance with international law. How does that actually work?
This is where the US system is particularly instructive, because it's the most developed. The United States has multiple legal and policy frameworks that condition military aid. The Foreign Assistance Act, the Arms Export Control Act, the Leahy Law, the Conventional Arms Transfer Policy. Each of these imposes different requirements. But they all share a common enforcement challenge. The mechanism for verifying compliance is opaque, under-resourced, and rarely triggers actual consequences.
Walk me through the Leahy Law, because that's the one that gets cited most often.
The Leahy Law prohibits the U.S. from providing military assistance to foreign security force units that have committed gross violations of human rights. It sounds straightforward, but in practice, it requires a vetting process. The State Department has to determine whether specific units are credibly implicated in violations, and that determination requires evidence, investigation, and a willingness to make a finding that will have diplomatic consequences.
If nobody's investigating, nobody's being found in violation.
The law exists, but the investigative machinery has to be activated. And the GAO report I mentioned earlier, the one about zero end-use monitoring visits to Israel in 2024, that's directly relevant here. If you're not conducting monitoring visits, how are you gathering the evidence to make Leahy Law determinations? The answer is, you're relying on public reporting, NGO documentation, and whatever intelligence reaches the relevant desks. But that's not the same as a systematic compliance verification process.
The Leahy Law is a legal framework without an automatic enforcement trigger. It requires someone to pull the lever.
Pulling the lever has enormous diplomatic implications. If the State Department makes a formal finding that an Israeli unit has committed gross violations of human rights, that triggers a legal prohibition on providing assistance to that unit. The political fallout would be immediate and severe. So there's a strong institutional incentive to avoid making that finding, or to resolve concerns through quiet diplomacy rather than formal determinations.
The quiet diplomacy approach being, we've raised our concerns, they've assured us they're taking steps, and we consider the matter resolved.
That's a fairly accurate description of how a lot of these cases play out. And to be fair, quiet diplomacy can produce results. It can lead to changes in tactics, disciplinary actions, improved procedures, but it's not transparent, it's not systematic, and it doesn't create a public record of accountability. So when critics say the oversight regime is broken, and defenders say it's working behind the scenes, there's no way for an outside observer to adjudicate that dispute.
It's the oversight equivalent of a black box. Inputs go in, assurances come out, and the process in between is invisible.
This is where the distinction between government-to-government transfers and commercial sales becomes relevant again. For U.S. foreign military sales, there's a formal end-use monitoring program. Defense Security Cooperation Agency personnel are supposed to conduct regular checks. The system exists, but as the GAO documented, it wasn't being used for Israel in 2024. For commercial sales, under the direct commercial sales process, the monitoring is even weaker. The State Department's Blue Lantern program conducts end-use checks on commercial exports, but it's a small program with limited resources. In practice, most commercial exports are never physically verified after shipment.
We have three tiers of oversight: government to government with embedded monitoring that may or may not be activated, commercial sales with a paper-based system and occasional spot checks, and dual-use items that may not be covered at all. And an embargo has to somehow reach across all three.
This is why the honest answer to how do you enforce an arms embargo is imperfectly, inconsistently, and with significant gaps. The tools exist, but they're not designed for comprehensive enforcement. They're designed for a world where most exports are approved, and the exceptions are rare. An embargo flips that. Suddenly, you're trying to use a system designed for occasional denial to achieve comprehensive prohibition. And the system wasn't built for that.
It's like using a fishing net to catch all the water in a river. The net is perfectly good for catching fish. It's just not designed for the job you're now asking it to do.
That's a good image. And let me add one more layer of complexity. The knock-on effect. When a country imposes an embargo, it doesn't necessarily reduce the recipient's access to weapons. It often just redirects the supply chain. Israel, for example, responded to European embargoes by increasing domestic production and turning more heavily to the United States for resupply of key items like 155mm artillery shells and JDM guidance kits. The dependency shifts, but it doesn't disappear.
The embargo changes who supplies the weapons, not whether the weapons are supplied.
In many cases, yes. And this is particularly true when the recipient has a developed domestic defense industry. Israel's not a passive recipient of arms. It manufactures a lot of its own equipment. The embargoes affected specific categories of imports, components, and raw materials. They created friction and increased costs, but they didn't sever the supply chain entirely.
Which raises the question, if the practical effect is limited, what's the actual purpose of an embargo? Is it a policy tool or a signaling mechanism?
It's both. And the balance depends on the country imposing it. For some, it's primarily a signaling mechanism. It communicates disapproval to domestic audiences, to allied governments, to international organizations. The enforcement gaps aren't a bug, they're a feature. The embargo lets the government say, we've taken action, without actually disrupting strategic relationships or defense industry contracts.
The performative embargo. The diplomatic press release with an enforcement asterisk, as you said earlier.
For others, it's a genuine policy tool, but one constrained by the practical realities we've discussed. And I think this is where the prompt is pushing us toward a more nuanced understanding. When you hear about an arms embargo, you should ask three questions. First, does it apply to existing contracts or only new ones? Second, what's the enforcement budget and staffing? And third, are dual-use items included or excluded?
Those three questions will tell you more about the actual impact than the entire press release.
They'll tell you whether the embargo is designed to stop things or designed to generate headlines. And the answers are often buried in the fine print of government statements or not addressed at all, which is itself informative. If a government announces an embargo but doesn't specify whether existing contracts are affected, that's probably because they don't want you to know that existing contracts are still being fulfilled.
The silence is the answer.
The silence is the answer. And this connects to something I want to emphasize. None of this is secret. The export control community understands these dynamics perfectly well. The governments imposing embargoes understand them. The defense industry understands them. The gap between the public presentation and the operational reality is not an accident. It's a feature of how arms control politics works.
What should a reasonably informed listener take away from all this?
I think there are three actionable insights. First, an arms embargo is only as strong as its enforcement infrastructure. Without dedicated customs training, intelligence sharing, and post-shipment verification, it's largely symbolic. The announcement is the easy part. The hard part is funding the inspectors, training the customs officers, and building the intelligence networks to identify violations.
The press conference is cheap. The enforcement is expensive.
The enforcement budget is almost never announced alongside the embargo. Second, the most effective enforcement mechanism is cutting off government-to-government transfers, because those have embedded oversight. Commercial sales are much harder to police. If a country announces an embargo but carves out government-to-government programs or existing contracts, it's leaving the most controllable channel partially open. Third, the dual-use question is the elephant in the room. As weapons become more software-defined and component-based, the line between military and civilian technology gets blurrier. An embargo that doesn't address dual-use items is an embargo with a giant off-ramp. And most embargoes don't address dual-use items comprehensively because doing so would disrupt legitimate civilian trade.
Which brings us to the future. Where is this all heading?
This is what keeps me up at night. We're entering an era where the weapon is increasingly just code on a generic airframe. Drone swarms, AI-guided munitions, software-defined targeting systems. How do you embargo a software update? How do you verify that a civilian drone exported for agricultural surveying hasn't been repurposed for military reconnaissance? The traditional tools, export licenses, and end-user certificates and customs inspections, they're built for a world of physical objects with clear military characteristics. They're not built for a world where the military capability is in the software, and the hardware is a commercial, off-the-shelf quadcopter.
The embargo framework is industrial-age infrastructure, trying to regulate information, age weapons.
It's not keeping up. The Wassenaar Arrangement, which is the foundational international agreement on export controls for conventional arms and dual-use goods, was established in 1996. It's been updated, but the fundamental architecture assumes you can identify and control physical items. When the weapon is a software package that can be transmitted over the internet, the entire customs-based enforcement model breaks down.
You can't inspect a download at the port.
And we're already seeing this play out. The US has export controls on certain AI technologies and advanced semiconductors. But enforcing those controls requires a completely different approach than traditional arms embargo enforcement. It's about controlling access to cloud computing resources, monitoring technology transfers, regulating intangible transfers of know-how. The enforcement agencies are scrambling to adapt.
The future of arms embargoes is less about stopping ships and more about stopping data flows, which is a fundamentally harder problem.
A fundamentally harder problem with a fundamentally different set of tools. And I don't think most governments have really grappled with what that means. They're still announcing embargoes, as if we're in a world of tanks and artillery shells, while the battlefield is increasingly defined by software and dual-use components that don't fit neatly into any embargo category.
Which means the gap between the embargo headline and the embargo reality, which is already substantial, is probably going to get wider.
I think that's right. And that's not an argument against embargoes. It's an argument for being honest about what they can and can't achieve. An embargo can signal disapproval, it can create friction, it can increase costs, it can shift supply chains. What it rarely does is completely sever the flow of military capability to a determined recipient with a developed domestic industry and powerful allies.
To wrap this back to the prompt's core question, when a country announces an arms embargo, how does it ensure it's actually enforced? The honest answer is, it ensures it to the extent that it's willing to invest in enforcement infrastructure, to the extent that it's willing to accept the diplomatic costs of rigorous verification, and to the extent that the items in question are physical objects with clear military characteristics that can be identified at borders. Beyond that, it's a spectrum of partial enforcement, selective application, and political signaling.
That's a fair summary. The tools exist. The legal frameworks exist. The question is always whether the political will and the resources are there to use them. And in most cases, the answer is partially, inconsistently, and with significant carve-outs.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In
1897, a Russian expedition in the Aleutian Islands discovered a species of bacteria thriving in volcanic hot springs at temperatures exceeding 90 degrees Celsius. To put that in perspective, the water was hot enough to brew a cup of black tea, and the microbes were treating it like a pleasant afternoon bath.
They found the British grandmother of the bacterial world.
Brewing tea in a volcano. Honestly impressive microbial commitment.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for the fact, and for somehow always finding the most obscure corner of the natural world to pull these from.
If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love it if you'd leave us a review wherever you're listening. It helps other people find the show, and it makes Korn feel validated.
I don't need validation. I have leaf medicine and a rich inner life.
Find all our episodes at myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon with another one.
Until then, read the fine print on your embargo announcements. The silence is the answer.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.